It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the internet lets companies crowdsource some of their most simple jobs, but that's not always good news for the people doing those jobs. We'll find out how online companies are able to pay pennies for, in some cases, hours of work. First, House Republicans released the Nunes memo earlier today with the approval of President Trump, despite objections from the director of the FBI, other intelligence and law enforcement officials, and Democrats. Here's President Trump talking about the memo earlier today.
A lot of people should be ashamed of themselves, and much worse than that. So I sent it over to Congress. They will do what they're going to do. Whatever they do is fine. It was declassified. And let's see what happens.
Republicans said they wanted to release the memo for transparency and to hold law enforcement accountable. Democrats have seen it as an attempt to distract the public and discredit agencies investigating the president and his associates. Chris Edelson is an assistant professor in the Department of Government at American University. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, glad to be here.
I want to quote from the intro to the memo before they lay out the findings here. They say the findings, quote, raise concerns with the legitimacy and legality of certain DOJ and FBI interactions with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and two, represent a troubling breakdown of legal processes established to protect the American people from abuses related to the FISA process. Chris, does the information in the memo prove those assertions?
No, we can't tell. We don't have enough information, nor does President Trump, for that matter. President Trump said in the intro that you played that people should be ashamed of themselves. He doesn't know what was in the FISA applications. There's no reason he would. It's an investigation related to him. It would be very improper if he had seen that. We need a lot more to size this up. We need to know when you ask for a warrant from a FISA court judge, you submit a application. The brief memo here is cherry-picked, and we don't know what was in the application. Of course, there's a Democratic response to the Republican memo. The Democratic response has not been released, so we're just not in a position to really size this up.
This is all about, it looks like this memo, about a particular Trump campaign participant, a volunteer, I think at some point, Carter Page. Can you talk about his role in all of this and what sort of actions the memo is recounting related to him?
Carter Page, it's misleading at best to call him a volunteer. He was a national security advisor for the campaign who was introduced and highlighted by Donald Trump as part of his national security team. The memo describes him as a volunteer. It's a partisan memo, as Senator Lindsey Graham, himself a Republican, has said. So, yes, this has to do with a FISA application made concerning Carter Page that was apparently renewed several times. There had been apparently a FISA application made about him several years earlier, too. Adam Schiff, who's the ranking minority member of the committee, said that it would have been, I'm paraphrasing, he said it would have been delinquent for the government not to be looking at a Carter Page. In other words, there was good reason to be concerned that he was interacting with Russia in some way, and there are problems about that. We don't know the details because we don't have all the information. But, of course, Carter Page himself, one of the problems with this memo is Carter Page was one member of the team. There are other members. He's one piece of the investigation. Let's assume that the implications here are correct. Basically, what the memo is arguing is that somebody in the government, the FBI and the DOJ, was trying to mislead a FISA court judge and rely on a memo created by a partisan, Christopher Steele. Let's say that's right. At best, that casts doubt on one part of the investigation. It has nothing to do with the June 2006 Trump Tower meeting, with possible concerns about obstruction of justice or money laundering or any of the other things that may be investigated. So that's a problem, too. Even assuming the worst about this, it doesn't really get you all the way there on the whole investigation.
Prior to the release of this memo, Democrats, some who had seen the memo, said it shouldn't be released, that it could damage the FBI. It could reveal information about the investigation that shouldn't be public. Do you see that kind of damage from the release of this memo?
I'm not in a position to say, but it's worth pointing out it's not just Democrats saying this. Senator John McCain, a Republican, said this helps one person, Vladimir Putin. The FBI, which is headed up by a Trump appointee, Christopher Wray, issued a statement yesterday, I believe it was, saying they had grave concerns about material omissions in the memo. This is a really extraordinary thing that's going on. It's the only thing I can say is it looks like it's being teed up for two main reasons. One, possibly to lead to the firing of Rod Rosenstein, who's the Deputy Attorney General overseeing the Mueller investigation, or possibly the firing of Mueller himself. But if Rosenstein was fired, that could allow for control over Mueller. We don't know if that will happen, but there's reason to be concerned. And two, simply as something to give to the base. You know, this is what people on Fox News are going to talk this up, and they're saying it's worse than Watergate, which is a ludicrous suggestion, but this is something they can point to. But it's really an extraordinary thing. It's not an ordinary partisan disagreement, as Senator McCain and Senator Graham, to their credit, have pointed out today.
Chris Edelson is with us from the Department of Government at American University, looking at the release of the Nunes memo, what's in it, what happens with it. And Chris, you just mentioned Rod Rosenstein. President Trump had been asked if he still had confidence in the deputy attorney general. The president said, quote, "You figure that one out." I know we can't predict the future in this. What are you watching for when it comes to the future of Rod Rosenstein in that position?
Well, first, let's take a moment to consider that the president of the United States, in a very serious investigation, responded in the way you might expect an 8-year-old in the playground to respond. You figure that one out. It's really mind-boggling. All we can do is predict and, you know, speculate. I don't know for sure. I do know there's been reporting that Donald Trump is thinking about firing Rod Rosenstein. He certainly hasn't expressed confidence in him. There's been reporting that he actually instructed White House Counsel Don McGahn last year to fire Robert Mueller. And we know he did fire Jim Comey. So those are all concerns. One related point I should make is, if I'm Devin Nunes, if I'm Donald Trump, I'm concerned that what happened today might itself be evidence of obstruction of justice. So Robert Mueller, as his investigation continues, and as long as it does continue, seems to be looking to obstruction of justice. I think he might ask, why was this memo released? Is the goal to try to undermine the Russian investigation? How do you fit it into a bigger picture? I'd be concerned about that if I'm Donald Trump or Devin Nunes or other people involved in releasing the memo.
What are you looking for from congressional Republican leadership? You mentioned a couple of Republican senators, including John McCain, weighing in on this issue. Paul Ryan on the House side of things said he was in favor of the release of the memo. He has also said he would probably be in favor of the Democratic answer from that Intelligence Committee. What are you looking for from those Republican leaders who could play a key role, especially if the president fires some of these key figures we've been talking about?
It's hard to say. I think a lot of people have been disappointed. And Bill Kristol, who's a Republican, he was Dan Quayle's chief of staff, was on TV today saying he was deeply disappointed by Paul Ryan. He thought that Speaker Ryan was doing something dangerous here. And so, yes, you obviously, if you play out what could happen, if Mueller gets fired, if Rosenstein gets fired, the main check on that is sort of people are comparing to a replay of the Saturday Night Massacre from 1973 or a replay more recently of the Comey firing. When Comey was fired last year, Republicans responded by saying there was a need for a special counsel. So the same question would come up now. If Rosenstein and or Mueller were fired, would Republicans take steps to ensure the investigation continued? And I'm sorry to say, we don't know. We don't really know. We'd have to see. And I think it would be better if they are concerned about this, and some clearly are, Graham and McCain at least, it would be good for them to make that clear by laying down a bright line and saying, you know, firing Mueller or firing Rosenstein can't be done. Now, to be fair, Senator Graham did say that recently. He said, not for the first time, that if Mueller were fired, he said something like that would be the end of the Trump presidency. So that's pretty serious language. It would be worth knowing what other Republicans think about that, too.
All this is going on in an election year. There have been indications, concerns that Russian parties or parties close to the Russian government will again try to do something related to the American election, as they've done in Western European countries in recent years, too. With all this attention, these distractions maybe for the FBI, are you worried that not enough is being done to prepare for that?
Yeah. It's important not to overstate this, though. I think there are people, there are conspiracy theorists on the left as well, and sometimes people, you know, think Vladimir Putin has this magic power to undermine U.S. elections. He doesn't. There was a very close election in 2016 where a number of factors could have affected it. Just because Russia is interfering in the election, and by the way, that interference has not stopped. Sometimes people talk about, will it happen in 2018? It's been ongoing. There's reports about Russian bots that, for instance, were pushing this meme of release the memo. So they've been doing it. They haven't stopped. And why would they stop? The Trump administration has indicated no interest in taking action to respond to this. When Congress passed legislation last year over Trump's objections with a veto-proof majority, Donald Trump was given discretion to impose new sanctions on Russia. The deadline expired for that just the other day, and he did nothing. So I don't mean to overstate this, because because Vladimir Putin is not a magician, and he does not have magic powers to undermine the U.S. election or U.S. elections. But it's very strange. And a former acting CIA director, Michael Morell, described the Russian attack on the American elections as the intelligence equivalent of 9/11. To watch a presidential administration and a Republican Party in Congress that has not responded forcefully to this is bizarre, and I think a mistake.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure.
That's Chris Edelson, assistant professor in the Department of Government at American University. He joined us for a look at the latest news surrounding today's release of the Nunes memo. More and more people are turning to the internet to make a little extra money, but for a growing number of Americans without better job options, low-wage online work is becoming their main source of income. Websites like Crowdflower, ClickWorker, and Amazon's Mechanical Turk provide people with simple, repetitive tasks like filling out surveys or personality questionnaires. The pay for those jobs can be as little as a few pennies, but workers will still spend hours searching and competing for them. Alana Semuels is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She recently wrote a piece exploring this little-known corner of the internet. Alana, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, these are not household words, these companies. Can you tell us a little bit about these companies that are recruiting people to do piecework, I guess, online?
Sure. The biggest one is probably Amazon's Mechanical Turk. And basically, academics or people who are trying to get surveys done or some sort of task work, post these surveys they're just surveys online, and they ask people to do them. They usually pay very little because they're just asking people to work for about 5 to 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. And you have a lot of workers signing up.
The idea, I guess, initially the pitch would be, okay, you got a little spare time, you're not really accomplishing anything anyway, you can make a couple bucks, no big deal. But you found that some people are looking at this as an important source of their income.
Right, exactly. For a lot of people in places where there aren't really very many good job options, this seems very appealing at first. It's, I can sit in front of my computer and I can make $100 in a day. Unfortunately, it's not actually panning out that way. There's a recent survey that found that people make on average $2 to $4 an hour. So people think that this is very appealing, and there are certainly some people that make a decent amount of money on it. But for the vast majority of people, it's less than the minimum wage, and they're finding they're putting a lot of time sitting in front of the computer and not getting any money.
And if I were to go online and do this tonight, I would not be an employee of the company, right? I'm a contractor, basically. What does that mean in a legal sense?
Right. You're an independent contractor, which means you're not covered by minimum wage or overtime protections. It means it's more difficult if you feel like you're being abused by the person asking you to do the tasks. It's more difficult to, ask them for money or, if they don't pay you, it's more difficult. It's just more difficult to kind of get protected by the law. And so that's why, when I first saw this and I saw people are making on average $2 to $4 an hour, I thought, well, that's not legal. The minimum wage, I believe federally it's $7.25. So how are people making less than half of that? But they're not covered by minimum wage protections because they're not actually employees. They're independent contractors.
And you say that, a lot of people are getting paid $2 to $4 an hour. And that's, as I understand it, for the time they're actually working. They actually spend a fair amount of time finding these things. And in some cases, they might do the whole whatever online, whatever that job is, and their work can be rejected and they don't get paid at all.
Right. That's part of the problem, is that if you piecing together all of these little tasks, you're going to spend a lot of time looking for them. You're going to spend a lot of time bidding or, trying to get them instead of other people, because there are a lot of people on these sites. And you're going to spend time reading the directions. You're going to spend time making sure that you understand the directions. And the time that you actually do the tasks is pretty short. And that's what you're getting paid for. So you think about it, someone who drives for, it's similar to someone who drives for Uber. If they decide to drive in, say, Milwaukee instead of, where they live in more rural Wisconsin, they're not getting paid for the time that they're driving to Milwaukee. It's kind of similar. These people aren't getting paid for the time that they're searching for work. They're just getting paid for the work that they do. And so I talked to people that would sit in front of the computer for, 15, 16 hours a day, and they'd make, $20 for the whole day. And that can get really frustrating. I mean, I think probably your listeners have the experience of sitting in front of the computer and not feeling like you're getting anything done. But for a lot of these people, imagine having that feeling, but it's kind of, whether you're going to have enough money to keep the lights on.
Talking to Alana Semuels from The Atlantic about a lesser known part of the gig economy, people who do work for not much money, little bits and pieces of work online, surveys, reviewing reviews sometimes of restaurants or products or whatever. And Alana, you talked to a woman in Ohio, a 29-year-old woman. You used the name Erica. She didn't want to share her real name, I guess, because she did this through the Amazon Mechanical Turk thing, and she didn't want her account to get shut down. So what did you learn about her work day doing this?
Yeah, she was really interesting because she was very smart, she has an associate's degree in nursing, but she just said, there's nothing in my Southern Ohio town that I can make a living doing. So she spends about 30 hours a week doing this. She has a 10-hour a week part-time job that pays minimum wage. But, she'll, for example, one of the tasks that she had recently that she said was just totally not mind-numbing was she had to press a key when a blue triangle popped up on her screen. And she just, do that for like 15 minutes straight and then, maybe do another one that's similar. And she made $4 to $5 an hour. And she was just finding, although this was initially, she thought this was a good option for her to supplement her income. She eventually figured out that she really wasn't making a lot of money doing it. And, she would do tasks sometimes and realize that she didn't do them right. So she'd have to return them to the person who hired her, or she'd do them and then she wouldn't get paid because the person who hired her said, this isn't right. We didn't do this right. So she really hoped that this would be some sort of savior for her. And for her, it was kind of, she thought it would be a good thing because they pay daily or every other day. Whereas if you do some other job, you get paid, every 2 weeks or twice a month. So it was good for her to get $20 if she had to pay her electrical bill. But sometimes she wouldn't even have that. I think it was really frustrating for her because she thought initially that this would be, a great way to make some extra money. And she really found out quickly that it was much harder than it seemed.
And another wrinkle is that I guess if I went to sign up for this and I looked at a particular job, it would say how much I got paid and how much time it was going to take me. And that time isn't always accurate. Is that right?
Right. So they'll post, they'll say we'll pay you $1 and then they'll say how much time it will take. And then they'll put a limit on it. So they'll say you have to do this within 45 minutes. That's one of the reasons the requesters do it is because if they farm out, to 1,000 people and they say they all have to do it in 45 minutes, they're going to get it back much more quickly than if they give it to one person and, have them do 1,045 minute segments. But a lot of times the directions will be confusing or people just won't make it in that amount of time. And so that's also really frustrating. Now, there are some kind of workarounds. There are websites, and Reddit is a forum where people talk about the different requests and which ones are good and which ones are bad. But, for someone that doesn't know about those sites or if certain requesters haven't been reviewed yet, then you're still going to run into that problem of running out of time or finding people, getting jobs from people that aren't going to treat you very well.
And you wrote not just about Reddit, but other efforts by people who are doing these kind of jobs to kind of band together a little bit. What are they doing and what are they hoping to change?
Well, there's this project out of Stanford where they basically tried to create a site where all these workers could suggest things to the requesters. So, I think a lot of the requesters are actually pretty open to hearing how they can improve, especially a lot of academics. It ultimately came to be that there weren't enough people who were really active. I mean, there's a lot of high turnover in these sites where people start them and then they figure out they can't make any money and then they leave. This one site out of Stanford, you needed to do a task for Mechanical Turk before you could get into this site. And Amazon figured that out and actually shut down the account that was giving the people the tasks. So it kind of petered out. you know, they changed the website, they changed the format of the website. So another one of these kind of plugins that people download on their browser also went on the fritz. So it seems like every time workers come up with a way to try to make it better, something changes from Amazon or from the other sites that makes it more difficult to do that.
And we have heard a lot about the gig economy over the last bunch of years, whether it's something like Uber or Lyft or services to deliver food or run errands for people, especially in bigger cities. Do you see that maybe we're not taking care of the people doing these jobs? They're not getting the benefits that they were hoping for?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these people don't get any health care benefits. They aren't protected by unions by any stretch. They aren't making minimum wage. And so, you know, I think one professor said to me, it's interesting that these people haven't organized or there's no one protecting them. But there's also this kind of stigma around internet work where, you know, if you're working at a McDonald's or you're working for Uber, you're much more visible to people and people know you're doing this to try to make a living. Whereas if you're doing stuff on the internet, people think, oh, you're just doing that to earn some extra cash. You must have another job. We're not going to really worry about you. We're not going to try to organize you. So I think, you know, this is definitely kind of an unseen pool of workers, and especially because it's hard for them to connect with each other. You know, there's no physical connection there. Maybe they'll connect online through different forums, but it's a little harder to kind of get people excited about organizing or about, you know, advocating for protections when you don't actually know what these people look like or where they live. You know, some of them might be living in India or Canada or somewhere else. So it's a big challenge for starting some sort of labor movement or protections for them.
Alana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Alana Semuels is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She was with us for a look at a growing online industry of crowdsourcing that's paying people fairly low wages for doing repetitive tasks online. First, before the public learned about a major reorganization of the state's UW system, it was described as an open secret at the state capitol. Rich Kramer reports that the plan to restructure the UW's two-year colleges and extension programs was launched without input from the public, staff, or students.
On October 10th, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported on a plan to merge the university system's 2- and 4-year campuses and move programs from UW Extension to other parts of the system. System President Ray Cross said it was in response to declining enrollment and changing state demographics. The leaked proposal was a surprise for employees and students. Even UW Colleges and Extension Chancellor Kathy Sandeen said she'd first seen details the day before. But during a visit to the state capitol before the story broke, UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank told President Cross that his plan was an open secret there. In emails obtained by WPR, she said 4 lawmakers asked her about it, including one who had obviously spoken to Cross. Blank declined to be interviewed for this story.
It was less than 2 weeks before it was made public that I got a call from Ray Cross.
That's Republican State Representative Dave Murphy, who chairs the Assembly's Committee on Colleges and Universities.
For me personally, I think he knew that it would be something that I could go along with it, and it's probably based on the discussions that we had had earlier.
In 2015, Murphy called for eliminating or reforming UW Colleges and Extension, but he says he didn't ask Cross to do it. As committee chair, he says Cross's call was a courtesy, and there was reason to limit how many people knew about the plan.
You know, if you open this up, it could end up just being a free-for-all. As far as trying to bring student and faculty and everything together to discuss this, you'd never get it done.
In an email to a member of the Board of Regents, Cross expressed similar frustrations. He said if shared governance had been involved, quote, we wouldn't be doing anything. UW La Crosse Emeritus Professor Joe Heim says the approach was unusual, but being responsive to lawmakers isn't surprising.
They do have an enormous influence over the university budget, and a person would be a fool not to pay attention to the people who control the gold, shall we say.
On October 11th, Cross sent an email asking how the news was going over at the Capitol. The UW's representative there said Republican lawmakers were taking the restructure and other policy changes backed by their caucus as a sign the university was, quote, being aggressive and forward-thinking. But that wasn't the reaction from many UW faculty, staff, and students. Holly Hassel chairs the Faculty Senate at UW Colleges. She says slowing the process down wouldn't have been a bad thing. Hassel says faculty expertise could have helped avoid potential problems that have come to light since the plan's release.
It doesn't mean it wouldn't get solved or it wouldn't get addressed, right? And I think the faculty, staff, and students who've been involved in shared governance would have welcomed the opportunity to be presented with a plan, a proposal, right? Like, here are some issues.
Groups with expertise on university governance say an inclusive approach is best. That includes Michael Polyakov of the conservative-leaning American Council of Trustees and Alumni.
Public institutions gain public trust through transparency, and they, above all, preeminently should be modeling open discourse, a kind of discourse that is appropriate for a free society.
1 month after its unveiling, the UW Board of Regents approved President Cross's plan, and an advisory steering committee was established. Of its 25 members, there are two faculty, including Professor Hassel, one staff member, and one student. UW spokeswoman Stephanie Marquis says after a rough introduction, all stakeholders are involved in remaking the University of Wisconsin system.
So I think that we would be the first to acknowledge that this wasn't rolled out the way that we planned or the way that we anticipated or would have liked to do. But I think what's really important is that we have to move forward, think about what do we need to do for our students, because that's really what this is about.
And the university will be moving forward by July 1st. That's when the merger of the 2- and 4-year campuses is slated to be completed, but administrators say portions of the plan will take years to complete. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, in Wisconsin, we take our cheese-centric dishes very seriously, but for today's Food Friday, we're actually letting a Texan talk to us about cheese. We're going to head into the South for a deep dive into the gooey world of queso, the southwestern chili cheese dip that you might find yourself dipping into this Super Bowl Sunday. Lisa Fain joins us now. She blogs as the Homesick Texan, and her new book is Queso, Regional Recipes for the World's Favorite Chili Cheese Dip. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. I'm actually in Central Time right now myself, so I'm in Texas.
Oh, great. Well, you're back home in Texas, so not homesick today, I guess.
No, I'm not.
Talk about the basics of what is queso. Is there like a solid definition? It's got to have this or it's not queso.
Well, you know, queso is a very many-splendored thing. Like many Texans, and actually Midwesterners as well, I grew up with thinking that queso was essentially Rotel dip, which is a brick of Velveeta cheese melted with a can of tomatoes and green chilies. And this is what I grew up eating, and it's delicious, it's simple, it goes well, it carries well, it's a great potluck dish. But when I was 25, I moved to New York, and in New York, they didn't sell Velveeta or Rotel. And it was actually a Super Bowl weekend, 1996, the last time the Dallas Cowboys were in the Super Bowl, and I was going to have a party, and I wanted to make queso, and I couldn't find these things. And so I had to relearn what queso is and learn other ways to make it, and this kind of began my obsession with chili con queso. But the name is chili con queso, so for me, my basic definition of chili con queso is it has to have cheese, of course, and it has to have chili peppers. So those are the two building blocks of all the different kind of quesos you can have.
Now, here you are. You're writing this book on chili con queso, and you, I understand, really threw yourself into your research. There's no possibility that you could eat too much chili con queso to get to the bottom of things.
No. This is probably the most fun project I've ever had. I spent about 4 months eating queso every day, and a lot of that time, about a month, was spent actually out in the field in Texas and in southern New Mexico, and I went to Arkansas, and I was just driving around eating. I wouldn't eat the full bowl, but I would, you know, probably dip into about 10 quesos every day, and then, you know, I go back to New York, and I'm recipe testing, and so for 4 months, I ate queso every day, and I had a few other things, like I'd eat salad or beans to, you know, get some other nutrients in my body. But the funny thing was, at the end, I ended up losing 10 pounds.
I don't know how that works.
I don't either. You know, I went to my doctor, and she goes, "You've lost weight." And I was like, "Really?" Because I don't have a scale. And she goes, were you trying to lose weight? And I told her what I've been doing. And she goes, "Well, you know, queso's low carb. So I guess there is maybe, yeah, there's an argument for the queso."
We'll watch for your sequel, The Queso Diets. Now, you looked not just into the making. We're going to get into some recipes in a bit. But you looked into the history of chili con queso. How far back did you go? What did you find as the early origins?
Well, you know, it was kind of hard to pinpoint. I spent a lot of time at libraries in Texas and actually doing research through the New York Public Library and such. My obsession with the history of queso actually stemmed from Okay, well, the people of Arkansas were claiming that chili con queso came from Arkansas. And I was like, that can't be right. It's chili con queso. That just doesn't make sense. And so I started doing research, and, you know, I assumed that it probably did come from Mexico, and it did. But what I did was I read a bunch of old cookbooks and newspaper articles and things like that. And I wasn't able to find the exact, you know, point when it was invented. But the earliest recipe that I found citations in poetry and literature from Mexico. But the earliest recipe that was chilies with cheese was in the late 1800s, and it was called Chilies Poblanos. And that was in a Poblano, Mexico cookbook.
And we've got that recipe. You shared it with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. So tell us about this primordial chili con queso recipe, Chilies Poblano.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, in northern Mexico, in the state of Chihuahua and, you know, El Paso, which is right across the border from Juarez, which is a Chihuahuan state, and even southern New Mexico, that area, they have actually their own, what they say, they serve chili con queso there, but it's very different from what you would get in the rest of Texas. You know, traditionally, most people think of queso as a processed cheese dip. But in that part of the world, northern Mexico and El Paso, they serve queso, but it's made with white melting cheese, so like Monterey Jack or Munster or Asadero. And so this recipe I found is very similar to what they're still serving today in that part of the world. And the chilies poblanos, it's just tomatoes. It's poblano chilies, which have been roasted and skinned and cut into strips. And it's milk, and the cheese wasn't specified, but a lot of the recipes in this cookbook called for Gruyere or Asadero, so I made it with either one, and it was delicious. And it's a thick. It's not really a dip. It's kind of hard to explain. It's like queso fundido, where it's just sort of grilled, and it's thick, and it's a little soupy. And so you can't really put your chips into it because it's a little too thick. But you can, you know, spoon it in tortillas. But it's quite delicious.
That's one of the basics. And then you found that people took queso in a lot of different directions.
Yes, yes. Well, one of my things that I was trying to figure out in the history is when did it go from being just chili peppers and white cheese to being, you know, this processed cheese dip that you, you know, actually stick chips into. And in the early 1900s, Welsh rarebit was really popular in the United States, and a lot of the recipes that you would find were made with American cheese, and it'd be like American cheese and beer, and you'd, you know, pour it over toast. And then there was a recipe for something called Mexican rarebit, and it was American cheese, tomatoes, chili peppers, and some aromatics, and beer. And when I made this recipe, I think it was from the 19-teens, it tasted so much like queso. So I kind of pinpointed that as one of the turning points for queso to become an American cheese dip.
We are talking about all things queso, cheese dip, chili con queso with our queso expert, Lisa Fain. She's the author of Queso, Regional Recipes for the World's Favorite Chili Cheese Dip. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you make a cheese dip often, or maybe at special occasions like Super Bowl Sunday? Do you have a favorite go-to recipe, a secret you want to share, exactly the right kind of cheese? Is there a Wisconsin cheese that makes the best dip? Or do you have a question for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post and find a link to a couple of recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. I want to look at another one of those recipes now, Lisa. Felix queso. Tell us about that one.
Well, this is a very unusual chili con queso. It's named after the man who owned the eponymous restaurant. His name was Felix Tijerina. He was a Houstonian. And he opened his restaurant in 1937, and it was, you know, just classic Tex-Mex, which is, you know, cheese enchiladas covered in chili con carne, smothered in cheese and onions. And his queso, however, was very different from other chili con quesos that you would encounter then and even now. It's really thick, and it's kind of hard to describe. I would say paste-like, but that doesn't sound very appetizing. But it's super thick, and it's made with American cheese and tomatoes and chili powder and paprika and some sautéed onions and some tomatoes and garlic. And it's an acquired taste. But once you acquire it, it becomes very addictive. And there's really, I have never discovered any other chili con queso like it. In my research, I was trying to figure out where this came from, and I actually really have no idea, nor does anyone else. But it's very delicious.
In your description, the picture looks great. You use the phrase oozing with red grease. And seeing the picture, that actually looks good. The phrase doesn't make it sound good, but it looks really good.
Yeah, it goes either way. People either love the grease or they don't love the grease. But, I think it's actually very delectable.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Denise is with us from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Denise, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
We sure can. What did you want to tell us about?
Hi, I'm actually lived in Texas, and whenever I make pita and the release, but I always added the Jimmy Dean sage sausage to it, and it is delish.
Oh, you
had an excellent addition. I love that.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Denise. And do we see people adding sausage or other meats to chili con queso very often?
Oh, yes. That's very, very common. Breakfast sausage, you know, sage-based breakfast sausage, Mexican chorizo made with chili peppers, fajita meat, brisket, smoked brisket, anything goes when it comes to adding meat to chili con queso.
Denise, thanks a lot for that call. And Lisa, you've got the dips themselves and a lot of different variations, but you also have recipes that use some of these dips, Huevos Rancheros, El Paso style. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Yeah, that's unusual because typically when you order Huevos Rancheros, the ranchero refers to a ranchero salsa, which is a tomato-based salsa with tomatoes and green chilies and, you know, onions and garlic. But in El Paso, when you order Huevos Rancheros, it comes with an American cheese-based sauce with tomatoes and chili peppers. It's essentially queso. And you see this in all the restaurants in El Paso, and it's a double confounding thing because, first of all, the queso that you usually get there, like I said earlier, is made with white cheese, not processed cheese, but they put processed cheese on their eggs, and they call it ranchero, even though it's not a ranchero salsa. I really don't know where this came from, and nobody does either. I asked a lot of people, and they're like, nope, we've just always done it this way. But it's so good.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is on the line in McGregor, Iowa. Jim, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My wife and I have been trying to come up with the right cheese for the type of queso that we've really enjoyed from Mexican restaurants. And it's used, it melts. It's not thick at all. It melts really well, and we've asked various sources about it. A lot of times they've suggested Monterey Jack, and that is certainly good, but it's awfully thick, and we've tried adding cream to it, and it doesn't seem to be quite the same. So this cheese that we're thinking of is just a delightful combination of flavor and consistency. It's just a really delicious mixed with chorizo or peppers. And so I wondered if you might have a suggestion for the type of cheese that
Jim. Lisa, any suggestions? What kind of cheese should Jim experiment with?
I would suggest, I gather, most restaurants use something called Velvet Melt or Easy Melt, and you can't buy that. That's made by Land O'Lakes, and it's not available to consumers. It's a restaurant-only product.
Uh-huh.
But and it's magical. But to approximate that flavor, what I would do is I would do white American cheese, and I would get the kind from the deli. You can ask, you know, the deli for, you know, a pound or a half a pound of white American cheese. And then I would make a sauce with either dairy or beer or broth and thicken it with cornstarch. And I'd also add some onions and some garlics and your chili peppers. And then I'd probably do half American cheese and melt that into the broth. And then I'd add half Monterey Jack, so equal ratios. And so you get the tang of the Monterey Jack, but the white processed cheese will smooth it out and make it thin and make it dippable.
All right, hope that helps. Let's go now to Sandy with us in Williams Bay. Sandy, hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Sandy?
I spent a long time in Austin, Texas when I was in grad school, and there was this restaurant way down south Austin, like on Manchac. I think it was called the Texan, and they had a queso flammeado, which was amazing. It was white cheese, and they would light it on fire. And I don't know if it's traditional, but it's the best queso I've ever had.
Wow.
Yeah, that's actually very traditional.
A flaming queso is traditional, Lisa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I when I was in college, I worked in a Mexican restaurant, and that was one of my jobs. And you pour Everclear over it, and then you take it to the table and you light it. It's very dramatic.
Wow. Now, you've got an Austin diner-style queso here. Just skimming through the recipe, I'm not blowing it up at any point, though. I don't think, right?
No. That's a very classic queso. But there is queso flamellado in the book that suggests it tells you about the fire. But my publisher actually said that I couldn't really talk about it because I might get sued. So I don't really give you descriptions on how to set the queso on fire.
All right. Don't try this on at home, kids. We don't want to ruin anyone's Super Bowl Sunday. So you've tried all of these quesos from around the region, Lisa. If there's a stereotype of people from Texas, and I hate to contribute to it, but I would assume that people from Texas think that the Texas thing is the best one. So are you gonna make the case that Texas, even though other people do it, Texas does it best?
Yes, of course. I'm a seventh generation Texan, and I am a loyalist. So Texas queso is the best.
And for people who are thinking, okay, I'm going to do this on Super Bowl Sunday, I'm going to get the tortilla chips, give us the one or two that you'd recommend going for the big game.
In my book, I would do the Austin-style diner queso, which is just this classic queso, and you approximate that flavor, that restaurant flavor, that Velveeta doesn't quite have. If you use the American cheese with the cornstarch-based sauce, it's smooth and it's like one extra step. But it's creamier because American cheese has more dairy in it than Velveeta does. So that's one of my favorites. And then, but again, there is absolutely nothing wrong with Velveeta. And if you're going to go old school, you know, the brick of Velveeta with a can of Rotel and then putting things in it like chili or sausage like Denise does or chorizo, you know, and then you can even liven it up with Monterey Jack and cheddar and pepper jack and cilantro and salsa. You know, that when you start with the real simple basic of the Velveeta and the Rotel, you know, it's this palette that you can add anything to.
And if we add a little maybe extra sharp Wisconsin cheddar in there, that's not going to hurt anything,
oh,
right?
Oh, no, that would be so delicious.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Lisa Fain. She blogs as the Homesick Texan, and she's the author of the book we've been talking about. It's Queso, Regional Recipes for the World's Favorite Chili Cheese Dip. We've been learning all about queso. I avoided our producer Carl's puns. I took them on a queso-by-queso basis. There, Carl, I got one in for you. You can find a couple of the recipes we've talked about, these queso recipes. They're over at the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can go right to WPR.org/Food Friday. And if you're making one of these dips for the big game on Sunday, think about your pals at Central Time and drop some off. Oh, no. Wait, that's going to be too late. Take a picture of them, though, and upload it over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. The Super Bowl is Sunday. It's the Philadelphia Eagles against the New England Patriots. A lot of people are picking sides, you know, apart from the hometown fans, of course. A Monmouth University poll finds 43% of Americans are pulling for Philadelphia, only 18% for New England, I guess on the grounds that they've won it plenty. That leaves a lot of people, though, not picking between the two, and that includes Super Bowl halftime performer Justin Timberlake. Now, here's what he said when an interviewer asked which side he was going to root for.
Go Pack Go.
Go Pat?
Pack.
Patriots.
Patriots. Go.
I'm telling Tom Brady.
He made it pretty clear there. He's rooting for a team that, of course, sadly, is not anywhere near the Super Bowl this year. And he's, I assume, like a lot of people, not taking sides and just picking another team or just watching for fun. I don't know if he'll be able to watch much because he's going to be performing. And I imagine, you know, maybe given past performance, there might be a wardrobe malfunction where we see that as an undershirt, he's wearing a throwback Packer jersey. And we can suggest maybe a good cover song that he can unveil at the Super Bowl. This is Central Time.